If you'll gather round me, children, a story I will tell about Pretty Boy Floyd, an outlaw. Oklahoma knew him well. It was in the town of Shawnee, a Saturday afternoon. His wife beside him in his wagon, as into town they rode. There a deputy sheriff approached him in a manner rather rude. Vulgar words of anger, and his wife she overheard. Pretty Boy grabbed a log chain, and the deputy grabbed his gun. In the fight that followed, he laid that deputy down. Then he took to the trees and timber to live a life of shame. Every crime in Oklahoma was added to his name. But a many a starving farmer the same old story told, how the outlaw paid their mortgage and saved their little homes. Others tell you about a stranger that come to beg a meal. Underneath his napkin left $1,000 bill. It was in Oklahoma City, it was on a Christmas day. There was a whole carload of groceries come with a note to say, well, you say that I'm an outlaw, you say that I'm a thief. Here's a Christmas dinner for the families on relief. Yes, it's through this world I've wandered. I've seen lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six gun, and some with a fountain pen. And as through your life you travel, yes, it's through your life you roam, you will never see an outlaw drive a family from their home.
Yeah. These were the 30s guerrilla fighters, the beginnings of the guerrilla fighters. Now, a lot of people would scoff at that, but this is the way a lot of guerrilla armies started. They start out with criminality to support their cause. You know, Castro did it, Stalin did it, right-wingers did it, left-wingers did it. And if it hadn't been for Roosevelt and the boys maneuvering us into World War II, the United States was on the verge of a social upheaval, maybe a civil war. And the only thing that saved the fat cats was getting us into World War II. Of course, World War I, too. There was a lot of discontent before World War I. And getting us into World War I took the steam off, too. Whenever it gets to be too much steam at home, well, direct the frustration and anger outward to other countries, other people. That's the way they do it every time. So, John Dillinger, Pretty Boy Floyd, all these people would have eventually probably become leaders of guerrilla bands or even guerrilla armies if history would have been a little different. White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is White Aryan Resistance, and this is Tom Metzger. Terrible Tommy right here in the bunker. And we're ready to go. Are you ready to go? Yeah. Okay, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And our national phone number is 641-715-3800. Then put in the code 56890#, and you'll get a new message. And I'm starting to do them every day. A short comment on things I think you should know. So don't let me waste my time going up there and listen and leave messages. If you got some answers or rebuttals to what I say, put them up there. I've got thick skin, man. I got a really thick skin. Oh boy, and you got to have it. You got to be sort of like a rhinoceros. I think I'm going to put back up the phone line where you don't have to put in the code, and I'll put a long message on this, the line I just gave you, and leave it on there for, you know, maybe weeks. And then the everyday call on the other line, but I haven't done it yet. I'll try to do it this afternoon. And it's April the 21st, 2015. And this month is winding down, getting towards the end. Beautiful day here. Lots of wind. We got March winds in April. I'm telling you. You really got, it'll blow your hairpiece right off your head back here. Yeah. Well, I figured out a way to keep my coons out of my bird seed. He didn't make it in there last night. So we're all set there. But I don't want to have my birds go hungry, because we get the most beautiful birds. All kinds of beautiful birds that come here. And that word I couldn't remember yesterday was aviary. Yeah, that's what they call those places where the birds hang out. But they hang out. I've been feeding birds steady for all 3 or 4 years, summer and winter. And so we get lots of beautiful birds here. Interesting. You can learn a lot by watching nature, that's for sure. The different types of birds. Of course, the maximum numbers of birds around here are sparrows. They're not very good. They're not real good looking, but they're interesting to watch. And birds feed twice a day, once usually in the later morning, and then in the later afternoon, mid to later afternoon. It's interesting how you can almost set your clock by these birds. And the sparrows have an interesting pecking order. Now, there's a lot of bigger birds come in and try to push them around, but they seem to be able to handle it pretty good. You know, even if they have to jump out of the feeder and come back a little later. We got one bird back here. I think he's got a sort of a bluish and a white breast. He climbs trees upside down. He hangs on the feeders upside down. I don't know what kind of a bird he is, but pretty interesting. Then we got the nigger birds, I call them, the black birds. They come in here and try to muscle everybody around, but they don't get it accomplished all the time. Some of the doves come in, they're pretty heavy, and they come into the feeder like a bomber plane, you know. But even the blackbirds can't muscle them out. But they're pretty docile, other words. Okay, what do we got here? Let's find out some news here. Oh, on the message that I put up today on the other line, it's about how not to lose your job. How you can be a racist, fly under the radar, and not lose your job. In fact, they'll think you're a hero. I call it jujitsu. We got so many people that are always losing jobs because they open their mouth on the job about their racial views. You cannot do that. Now me, I'm public. Everybody knows me. There's no way I could fly under the radar. I am what I am, and I've been that way too long. But if you haven't flat out exposed yourself, you can not have these problems. And when I say jujitsu, I mean when you're on the job, just make like you're something you're not. You know. Be the liberal on the job. Now, I have a whole lot of guys that know exactly how to do this. They've been doing it for years, and when I talk to them, or once in a while, we laugh about what they do. You get a mixed crew, and some guy in a crew will say something mildly racist, and this guy will jump all over him. Well, that's horrible. You're insulting, and it's racist. So you position yourself as being the non-racist, but at the same time hiding your particular views. You got to be clever. You got to be shifty. You got to use a lot of tactics of, you know, they say, oh, the Jews are so clever and they do all this stuff. Well, shit, do it back to them. Well, hell yes. And when the blacks say something on the job, turn it around that they're anti-woman or they're anti-Mexican or they're anti-chink. Jump on them. Pretty soon, you'll get the reputation of being the job liberal. And nobody will give you any trouble. And you won't lose your job. In fact, you'll probably get promoted. Always do what they don't expect you to do. It's called the art of contrary thinking. And believe me, the art of contrary thinking is the best way to operate in all cases. A friend of mine up in L.A. worked for the city. This was years ago. And they'd get the blacks and Mexicans and a couple of white guys around there just shooting the shit. And so my buddy tells a joke. And it looks like the blacks are going to be the brunt of the joke. And they're all prepared for it. Here we go again. screw the black guy. And at the end of the joke, the punchline turned out it was the Mexican was the brunt of the joke. And they all went nuts on that. The black guys were quite happy not to be the brunt of the joke all the time. That's like the art of contrary thinking, that most of my thinking going down that road totally is out of phase with conservative right wing and the liberals. Yeah, I mean, I logically say that there never should have been any blacks brought into the country, and I would have been totally against the mercantilist capitalist who did that, and I would have been against the plantations in lieu of having small farmings for white families throughout the South instead of having the plantations and so forth. So when they say, how do you feel about the plantations, I say, well, I'll tell you one thing, I'd have been on the when they started bringing slave ships in, I'd have been on the shore waving them off, even maybe getting some guys and firing guns at them, turning around, go back to Africa. So I don't get in trouble for saying things like that, because that's a total switch on what blacks are used to hearing. You know, the mercantile system, King Cotton, was pretty rotten. It's like today, it's a lot of things, these corporations, they build up great fortunes, but they're not very nice the way they build up these fortunes. Plantations were like that. And you don't have anything to feel bad about, because the white working class in the South were treated worse than slaves, because slaves cost money. You know, a big, well-muscled black guy could bring as much as $1,000, maybe $1,500, or $1,500. And poor whites, they didn't get shit. They just got, they took whatever they could get. And the schools and everything else, the white working class in the South, see, there wasn't a giant middle class in the South. In fact, throughout history, there's hardly ever been a real strong middle class. The only reason we had a middle class is because we tromped the shit out of other countries, destroyed their industrialism and so forth, which for about 50 years put us out front with not too much of competition. So that's how that came about. So throughout history, there's not been much of a white middle class. You're either the plantation owner or you're the poor white person. A lot of times blacks will point that out to whites themselves, that there's more, a hell of a lot more poor whites in the country than blacks. And a lot of times the same laws that are enacted to affect a black guy affect the white poor too. So that's an interesting situation to be in, and we got to remember that. Can't support anything that supports the predatory capitalist. We can't support the Republican Party, that's for sure. Once in a while, there's something the Democrats try to do that's actually good. Because in the past, the Democrat Party has been a party not only in the South supporting the whites, but also it's been a party that supported labor, white labor, and along with the socialists. It's never been the Republicans that have really backed up the working class, because they support the ruling class. And the ones that are not in the ruling class are working as hard as they can and muscling everybody else to try to get in the upper class. I had a guy that says supposedly a white racist tell me the other day, well, I don't go for that classism. Well, you don't have any other choice. The ruling class created these classes. You're just a victim, or you're resisting them. You have to fight them, or else. The working class didn't create class struggle. The rich did. The ruling class. And everybody else is having to fight against the ruling class to get their piece of the pie. So when anybody says, well, I can't be involved with any kind of class issues, bullshit, who do you think's running the show at the top? The 1-2% of the people? And wake up out there, they're still mostly white, and they will screw you just as easy as any, you know, you're always going after the Jews. These white Christians will screw you even faster in most cases than the Jews. The major crime of the Jews was creating this religion that we're saddled with that's ruining the country. Christ insanity. That's the main thing that pisses me off about the Jews. They're the ones that spread it, and then it evolved into Christianity from Judaism, but it never really escaped Judaism, because when you go to church, what are you doing? You're studying the Torah and reading about the famous, wonderful heroes of the Jews and the Hebrews all the time. That's what I really dislike about the Jews. As far as their criminal activity, yeah, but not too much more than white Aryan rats that have turned on their race. That's why I don't get along with the right-wing conservatives, even of the racial struggle. Because, number one, they won't come right out, most of them, and call a spade, and consider anybody that really goes after the black race as a subservient, non-equal race. Whenever you do that, they say, oh, we can't have anything to do with them. Oh, that Metzger, he said nigger. I used to think that way, too. Years ago, I used to think that way all the time. Oh, I couldn't possibly say that N-word. Well, I learned that after enough time goes by and I looked at all the black street crime, mostly street crime, not corporate crime, that I lost any respect I might have had for the black race as in total. Once in a while I meet an individual black that I respect quite a bit, sometimes highly, but for the most cases I can't respect them, so sometimes I refer, and a lot of times I refer to them as a nigger, because they are non-evolved humanoids. They're way behind. Who knows, maybe a quarter of a million years. Well, you think that's not true? Well, the only way they get any place is copying white people. They don't, most of them don't invent anything. I guess they said some black invented the stoplight. Well, believe me, there's... I would have rather done without stoplights than have a country full of blacks. Now, this is not picking on blacks, really, because blacks are racist, too. All these radio shows on the air now, on XM and all over the place, they're racist as hell. But they don't accept it as racist, and they say, well, we got a right to be the way we are because of what you did to put them in slavery. The white working class of Europe and the United States never put blacks into slavery. It was the corporate elite mercantile interests and the ruling class that put them in. And if you're going to pick on anybody, or if they're going out with a hatchet to get somebody, they should not go after the working class with their machetes. They should go after the ruling class. And we shouldn't worry about it if they do. I see somebody sent a question in one of these websites on the internet, said, how would you respond if your Christian child converted to Islam? Well, I don't see any difference. They're all from the Abrahamic religion. Islam's no worse or no better than raw Christianity or Judaism either, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, a white Islamic who is, of course, they're wrong on the race issue. They're all three wrong on the race issue. The Islamic religion believes in race mixing, so does Christianity. So why should I pick between an Islamic and a Christian? They're all the enemy of the race in the long run, whether you like it or not. People forget what was done to white people and the white heathens and pagans in Europe. Millions were slaughtered by Jewish Christianity. Millions. Unspeakable crimes against white people. But when Obama brings up that what happened under the Crusades and so forth, well, he's right, of course. And Christians, if they weren't so materialist, if they didn't have so much materialism, if they weren't soft now, would be doing the same thing. Believe me, these fundamentalist Christians are scary. And if things get out of hand, you don't want them to be around them. You think that they're going to go with you? They're not going to go with you because they're religious fanatics. And whatever their preacher said, they'll listen to their preacher. And if their preacher says, well, there's that Metzger, he lives right over there, lives by himself with his gal, I think he ought to be taken out because he don't love the baby Jesus, they'd be right at my door with pitchforks and torches. And if you don't believe so, listen to some of these big preachers preaching to maybe 10, 15, 20,000 people at a time, like Hagee. Listen to what they're saying. Listen to what those fundamentalists are saying. Like I say, I've had my experience going into one of those gatherings and even raising my voice to say, I think you're a little unfair to the Palestinians and you're too much in favor of the Jews. I thought there was about 50 people going to grab me and kill me before I got out the door. Yeah. Don't think most of these white Christians are going to be on your side in any racial struggle. I believe I'd have more chances converting many of the progressives, along with the issues they believe in, to racism than I would getting these white Christians to mount a war for the race, because they're just not going to do it. A good share of our race, a good high percentage, are sick with the virus. And almost all of it came out of religion. The rest of it came out of greed. But the fundamentalist Christian works it out this way. Well, it's okay if Obama or Bush or any of them go overseas and kill millions of people. You know, like in Iraq, there's no America, hardly any. Well, on the left, at least some of the progressives, a lot of them say it was a wrong war. We shouldn't have been in the war at all, and we killed millions of people over there. At least they say that. The Christians don't say anything. The Christians say it's okay. Oh, Yeah, the war attack on Iraq. Well, he was supposed to have stuff, but he didn't have the stuff. Well, that's okay. Those were only Islamics, in fact, Saddam Hussein wasn't even Islamic. I mean, he was a non-religious leader and like that. But when our military bombs and strafes and burns people alive and like that, I don't hear these Christians around here crying about it. I don't see anything in the paper about it. And if you say something, a letter to the newspaper, do you think that's wrong? They say, oh, oh, you must be pro-Islamic. Well, I'm not pro-Islamic, but I don't believe in murdering millions of people either. So to that question about how would you respond if your Christian child converted to Islam, I'd feel bad, but I'd feel bad if he was a Christian too. I feel a life wasted on nonsense. And so take me out of that argument. I don't think the average Islamic is probably less dangerous than the average fundamentalist Christian. Well, let's read from our book on A Man Called Lucy. We haven't been at that for a while. His name was Roessler. And at the beginning of World War II, he was able to corral about 10 German officers in a high command and recruit them to a spy cell. And while he sat in Switzerland receiving the information through the telexes and so forth from Berlin, from the Central Berlin Command, passed them on not only to all the Western countries but to the Russians. But as usual happens, he gave the warnings and gave all the information to these Western lowland countries and so forth in England, but they didn't believe him. They thought he was a fake. And then later, as he gave all the exact battle plans of the Russian invasion, Barbarossa, to the Russians didn't believe him either. Only after a few times, when they found out he was absolutely right, they began to believe him. And so Roessler and his 10 high command generals and so forth were responsible, really, for the destruction of the Third Reich. Yeah, and that was quite a feat for one lone man to build that. And he built it down in Switzerland. And they used radio apparatus and hand-delivered messages and so forth. So now we're at the point where Schellenberg has taken over the OKW Intelligence Security Division of the Wehrmacht, and he's trying to trap some British agents down in Switzerland, so we're going to pick up there. Schellenberg was one of the brightest officers that had come along. And if the war would have lasted much longer, he would have nailed these 10 high-ranking officers. He was hot on their trail. Masson had laid down one condition to his accepting the meeting. It would have to take place in a town on the German-Swiss border. Laufenberg would do. Schellenberg had agreed, but had secretly determined that it would be far easier to beat an opponent on home ground in order to justify changing the meeting place to somewhere further inside Germany. Schellenberg needed a serious delay. Moreover, the delay should last long enough for a Gestapo agent to intensify Masson's sense of insecurity at being suddenly plunged into hostile surroundings, to condition Masson a little before actually confronting him. So Schellenberg invented an auto accident. You see, Masson was a high-ranking person in the Swiss military. When at 8:15 a.m. of a clear late summer Thursday, Brigadier Masson, wearing civilian clothes and sucking on an old pipe, crossed the international bridge over the Rhine, linking the Swiss and the German halves of the ancient city of Laufenburg. He was distressed to discover that arrangements had been drastically altered. Instead of being immediately conducted to the Gasthof Laufen, where he was to have been met by Egan and Schellenberg, Masson found himself being led by a silent German custom officer straight to the guard post at the German side of the bridge, where he was confronted by a stranger in a green trench coat who looked very much like the Gestapo. Though Masson cautiously declined to identify himself, the Gestapo officer did not hesitate to let Masson know he was aware of his destination. Quote, "You were expecting General Schellenberg, I believe. The general won't be coming to Laufenburg. He's had a car accident. Oh, nothing serious. Nothing to worry about, unquote. Masson was far from reassured to learn that Egan would come to collect him within a couple of hours. The minutes seemed to creep as the Gestapo officer fired a barrage of questions at Masson. What did the Swiss think of the way the war was going? Did they have any doubts as to the ultimate victory of National Socialism? It was a difficult situation. Masson grew increasingly anxious. What was happening? This car accident could so easily compromise everything. There he was, the head of Swiss intelligence, trapped in Germany, in the hands of the worst elements of the Nazi regime. Masson was perfectly well aware of the Nazi leader's attitude towards him. SS Reichsfuhrer Heinrich Himmler, for example, had been known to shout during one of his infamous fits of rage and anger when he would fire off pistol shots in his office. Wow, Bill. Wild Henry Himmler, Heinrich Himmler. Quote, I pay whoever gives me service. He who gives me disservice pays. I have no enemies. If I do make any, then I liquidate them. The scum of the earth will be liquidated, including Churchill and Roosevelt and Masson. That Swiss who has sided with them ever since the war broke out. And they did. The Swiss were double-dealing against the Germans. They claimed to be neutral, but they were like England claimed to be neutral in the beginning. At 10:30, a relaxed, affable Egan arrived. Yes, on the road from Berlin to Laufenburg, General Schellenberg's Mercedes had indeed crashed into a ditch. They were saved by a miracle. The general sent his apologies for the delay. They had been forced to come by train. But the meeting could still take place. Though not in Laufenburg, they would go to Wallstadt, 9 miles up the Rhine to the Baumhof Hotel. 9 winding, twisting miles along the banks of the river, Masson had reason to feel apprehensive. Should he feel Egan? Should he believe him? After all, Schellenberg could easily have come to Laufenburg with Egan or by train. Why had he chosen Wallstadt? Had he been trying to sap his moral and subjecting him to that agonizing wait with the Gestapo officer? The 32-year-old SS Brigadfuhrer was quite capable of such a trick. He had a reputation for doing that sort of thing. Masson was deeply disturbed, recognizing that he was quite possibly caught in one of Schellenberg's Machiavellian traps. Schellenberg was sharp. You got to study Schellenberg. He was something else. If he were not careful, he would end up in a triumphant grasp like Best and Stevens, or worse perhaps. Masson had, of course, already realized that there was some significance in the disproportion between Lieutenant Morgelli's error and his threatened punishment. Clearly, the SD, who had provoked the whole episode, wanted to contact him. Moreover, they intended to put him in a precarious position at the outset. Masson would be forced to ask for a favor. But what would Schellenberg want in return? The car driven by Egan entered Waldshut, the old tourist town of 10,000 inhabitants, built on a hill overlooking the Rhine. Just before the railroad station, they turned right down the Poststrasse. The Bahnhof Hotel was a gray, gloomy, three-story building. Major Egan led Masson into its small, dark, oak-paneled lounge. Shortly afterward, a man pushed open the door. He was tall and slim, wearing a superbly cut gray tweed suit. His thick brown hair was combed straight back and parted on the left. He had a wide, sensual mouth, gentle, deep-set eyes, and an attractive smile. Masson immediately recognized Walter Schellenberg. He was exactly like the photographs that his Lucerne office had supplied him before his departure. His voice, too, was gentle, though lightly ironical. Quote, I imagine you think that this hotel is filled with cameras and microphones, Monsieur Masson. After all, it's what you'd expect in wartime. I suggest, then, that we go outside. We can sit on whichever bench you choose along the embankment by the Rhine, unquote. The two men walked through the winding streets to the embankment. Here they sat beneath the alders and overhung the river. On the other side in the distance lay Switzerland, veiled in light mist. Schellenberg attacked at once, quote, "I must warn you immediately, Monsieur Masson, that I came here only after a great deal of hesitation. I have proof that your intelligence service is in the pay of the Americans," unquote. Schellenberg held out a paper. Masson recognized a copy of a cable sent by the American military attaché in Bern, Switzerland, to Washington in 1940. In June of that year, Masson had called a meeting of foreign military attachés. Rumor had it that Switzerland was about to be invaded. Panic was sweeping through northern Switzerland, emptying its towns and villages. Every room, every bed along the banks of Lake Geneva was taken. The American military attaché asked if it was true that there were 25 German divisions stationed between Basel and the Lake Constance. Masson had just received secret reports on the subject. Between Basel and Karlsruhe, there were no more than four divisions, the 554th, the 555th, the 556th, and the 557th. And under cover in the Black Forest south of Ulm and Rastatt were five more divisions fully equipped, a total war far from adequate for invasion, a total force far from adequate invasion. Careful to observe the strictest neutrality, Masson replied quite simply that there was some troop concentration to the north of Switzerland. Impressed by the importance of this information and anxious to emphasize his own part in the affair, the young American immediately cabled to Washington. Extraordinary meeting with Masson. He confirmed to me that there are 25 German divisions near the Swiss frontier. He added that they are all ready to attack, unquote. He then sent the cable by courier to the experts for coding. The courier was a German agent. On his way to the embassy, he copied the text of the message and dispatched it to Berlin. It was this copy that 2 years later Schellenberg now showed Masson. The brigadier returned it to the general, quote, "This does not prove that Washington finances my services, and you know it, Brigandfuhrer. Perhaps you wanted to demonstrate the efficiency of your espionage service." Schellenberg immediately parried, quote, "What do you want from me, Monsieur Masson?" The conversation was proceeding exactly as Masson had anticipated. It would inevitably lead to an offer of a deal. Quote, "You know that too. I asked for this meeting with the agreement of my superior, General Guisan. Only he and Colonel Barbie, his private chief of staff, know I'm here. I'm advised to inform you, as the general's official representative, that our position is frequently misunderstood in Germany and that we are determined to defend ourselves against any aggressor. I have also come to ask you to abandon the espionage system you are now building up against us." Masson paused for a moment, then carefully choosing his words, went on. "I would also like you to know that I am no fool. I admit I have been forced to come here to ask for pardon and safe return of Lieutenant Morgelli, one of my officers in Stuttgart who was arrested by your services," unquote. Schellenberg showed no hesitation. "Agreed." The brevity of the reply and Schellenberg's apparent nonchalance surprised Masson. Now what would he want in exchange? Quote, "Have you no other requests, Monsieur Masson?" Masson was disconcerted. What did Schellenberg want? At any rate, he resolved to take him up to his offer. In 1941, two Swiss Nazis, Ernst Lindhardt and Franz Bury, had settled in Vienna and set up an agency, the International Press Agentur. They had since conducted an all-out campaign against the Confederation, attacking Masson and the principles of Swiss neutrality. Many of their publications were getting into Switzerland via Lorach and Basel. Masson requested the suppression of the agency and was again astonished when Schellenberg immediately agreed. Then rising, he confronted Masson. Quote, "I speak for the Reich when I say that we should not like the relations between our two countries to be disturbed in any way. Switzerland is a neutral country and should remain so. A world at war needs somewhere where it can breathe freely. That place could be Switzerland. Within a month, you will have Morzelli back, and the agency run by Bury and Linhart would be shut down. But I must warn you that in Berlin, Ribbentrop's office in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, there is a very incriminating Masson file containing a great deal of information supplied by Bury and Linhart. I shall try and get a hold of it. There's a lot I can do, you know. By the way, thanks to me, Rothman. Rothman, the chief of your police division, will within 24 hours receive his visa to go to Berlin to settle some business about secret frontier crossings. Now let us go back to the Bahnhof for a little refreshment. Then Sturmbannführer Egan will take you to the bridge at Koblenz. I dare say you would like to get back to Switzerland as soon as possible, unquote. Round one of the secret struggle against Germany and Switzerland seemed to have gone entirely to Masson's advantage. Without argument and without at least commitment committing himself, he had obtained everything he wanted, and Schellenberg had asked for nothing. In fact, Schellenberg's amazing reasonableness on the occasion of the first meeting was only one more example of his diabolical cunning, and he was deeply satisfied with its outcome. While secretly forcing his hand, he had left it to Masson to make the initial contact. Should that meeting at Walschut and others that were to follow one day became known, the head of the Swiss intelligence alone would be held responsible. If the Allies learned of these meetings, Switzerland would be suspect of a tendency of reapproachment that was contrary to her own intentions and interests. One may well wonder if, apart from the many qualities that made Schellenberg one of the most remarkable secret agents of the last war, he did not also have, to an unusual degree, the ability to anticipate the future. The foresight that he showed on that occasion was even more far-reaching. By granting a pardon to Majelli and by promoting a close down of the International Press Agentur, he had quite simply put the Swiss in his debt, and without revealing earlier than he wished his motives for doing so. Schellenberg now knew that entry to the last island of free territory encircled in a Europe that was going up in flames would not be entirely denied him. More important, he had seized the initiative to put Masson very much off balance and then taken advantage of the situation to disconcert him even further by making one concession after another. Now Masson could hardly refuse him additional interviews. He must be enticed further into the net and suffocated by the progressively greater obligations before Schellenberg could ask the crucial question, the answer to which held the key to the very survival of the Third Reich. Did Masson know who was betraying the Wehrmacht? If in the end Masson still refused to cooperate, he could then be destroyed. Schellenberg's plan had one very serious defect. It needed time, and time was Germany's most precarious commodity, for things were happening with disturbing swiftness on the Eastern Front. This convinced him that the Russians were still receiving vital intelligence in abundance, intelligence that enabled them always with sufficient warning to evade whatever traps the Wehrmacht might lay for them. On September 2, 1942, for example, at a distance of about 25 miles from Stalingrad, lay an imposing belt of fortifications that blocked any access to the city. Defense of this line should be attacked head-on would require a great many men as well as a vast amount of material and ammunition. To the west flowed the Don, to the east the Volga, to the south the Karpovka, parallel to the Don, hills overlooking the Rossiyakha, a mere stream compared with the other great rivers. The summits of these natural strongholds were heavily fortified with guns and men. At their foot, Paulus and his Sixth Army awaited Hessen. Hoth was advancing from the Caucasus in the south, and the 48th Tank Division, a number of infantry divisions, and Rumanians of the 6th Corps. On that side, two hills preceded the steppe of the Kalmucks, broken by few ravines and led to Stalingrad. However, there was one weak spot in this defense system, a little town called Gavrilsovska. It was there that Hoth intended his breakthrough. If he succeeded, he would take the Russians from behind. Paulus could then attack, trapping the Russians in the classic encirclement so dear to the Wehrmacht strategists. They depended too much on that encirclement deal. They can make great gains, but if it goes wrong, they're screwed. The OKW agreed to the maneuver and the troops went into action. On September 2, 1942, in the early hours of the morning, German reconnaissance patrols signaled that the Russians had abandoned the positions in which they should have been annihilated. They had vanished. As if two days before, they had been reading over the shoulders of Hoth and Paulus the telegram approving the plan from the OKW. Nonetheless, Paulus gave orders for the advance to continue. You see, the Russians knew all about all this. Unknown to him, Eremenko and Zhukov lay in wait for him on the outskirts of Stalingrad in a place that made encirclement impossible. For Schellenberg, this and many similar episodes since the beginning of the Operation Blue confirmed any remaining doubts. His listening post in Dresden, now here's that Dresden coming up again, where everybody said was an open city. There was a lot of important things going on in Dresden. Anyhow, had reported that the clandestine broadcast came from Switzerland, were continuing uninterrupted from Switzerland, where the members of the opposition to the Führer plotted together and kept up innumerable contacts with enemies of the Reich, particularly with the Western Allies. One such contact had only just been uncovered. At the beginning of 1942, the Gestapo arrested a Munich businessman named Schmidthuber. He was suspected of smuggling foreign currency into Switzerland. Pressured remorsefully by the SD, he suddenly revealed that he worked for the Abwehr, and that was the Western Intelligence Division of the Third Reich, headed up by the traitor Canaris, and that he was carrying money on Admiral Canaris' orders. Investigation revealed that Schmidthuber had not been lying. Schellenberg's Bureau F in Bern, also undertook a lightning investigation in Switzerland. Let me see how much time we got here. Yeah, we got some time. The Abwehr, supporting Jews, this was just about the worst crime a Nazi could imagine. Realizing that Canaris would never escape this trap, Schmidthuber talked, hoping at least to save himself. He denounced Canaris, accusing him of trying to negotiate a peace with the British. Canaris' first attempt had been negotiated through the Vatican as early as December 39. Schmidthuber also revealed the names of the accomplices: Colonel Hans Ulster, Judge Hans von Danneyi, Oberlieutenant Joseph Mueller, and others who were later executed by the SS. However, even Schellenberg had connections of this kind with the British through one of his adjutants named Jahanka, but he hoped he would never need them. They were merely one more escape hatch in the unthinkable event of Hitler's being deserted by fortune. If the opponents of the Führer were capable of betraying Germany to the West, they could just as easily do so to the East. This is what strengthened Schellenberg's original conviction that the traitors he was looking for were to be found among the traditional opposition. After the Schmidthuber affair, Schellenberg left Wilhelm Canaris no freedom. In afterwards, when he became certain that the Admiral had no part in the extraordinary case he was now studying, he continued to hound him, goaded perhaps by a sadistic desire to hasten the Admiral's fall. He spied on him constantly, even following him on his riding excursions in the Berlin suburbs. It was Schellenberg himself who arrested Canaris in 1944 and drove him in his own black Mercedes convertible. To Fürstenberg, where he handed him over to a colleague, SS Brigand Führer Trumler. He then took over the Abwehr. incorporated into his own 4th and 6th counter-espionage bureaus. Now, he, at this point, he had tremendous power, Schellenberg, tremendous power, but they're running out of time, both in the East and the West. However, Schellenberg was not convinced that Canaris and his co-conspirators in Switzerland were innocent of the steady flow of military intelligence to the Russians until November 1942, a month after his second meeting with Brigadier Masson at Wolfsburg, Captain Meyer's house at Irmitagen. Irmitagen is a big village on the edge of Lake Constance. To the right of its square is an inn at which it is said Napoleon spent a night during his conquest of Europe. A narrow road leading to Sonterville winds its way up the hillside to the thick forest. But before it reaches Sonterville, at a distance of about a mile from Irmitagen, it emerges onto a plateau where there stands a great 16th century building known rather pompously as the Schloss. In fact, it is more like a manor house than a castle. This was Wolfsburg, where on the morning of Friday, October 16, 1942, Schellenberg and Masson met for the second time. It was arranged, as in September, on the initiative of the SS officer. A few days before, Schellenberg's protege, Egan, had remarked to Meyer that it would be a pity not to take advantage of the growing mutual understanding between the heads of secret services of the Reich and the Swiss Confederation. Schellenberg would very much like to come to Switzerland. So with the approval of General Guzan, Masson agreed to invite him. A secluded place had to be found for the meeting, for it was essential that Schellenberg should pass unnoticed. Swiss public opinion was now violently anti-German, largely due to the activities of Goleiter Bohl, a director of all Nazi organizations outside Germany. On October 4, 1942, Bohl left Germany to preside at a Harvest Festival meeting in the Holland Stadium in Zurich. The festival turned out to be a large-scale Nazi ceremony, complete with propaganda and military songs, attended by a considerable number of Germans who happened at the time to be in Switzerland. This was a tactical error on the part of the Germans. The Swiss were furious, and there were street demonstrations. So dangerous was the situation that the federal consul had to forbid all meetings of foreigners on its territories. What is more, Irmitagen was in the German-speaking part of the country, and the German-speaking Swiss were the fiercest opponents of Nazism. For them, it was betrayal of the very negation of German culture, and many of them had absorbed in German universities. In the event of the invasion, they too would be in the front lines. They were well aware that the brown shirts would like to take over their country. Maps distributed by Nazi propagandists left no doubt as to the Führer's intentions. These maps showing that Europe of the future and the frontiers of the Great Reich, destined to endure for 1,000 years, quite clearly enclosed German-speaking Switzerland. If any doubt remained, one only had to read the German press, which was filled with attacks on the Confederation. The Swiss responded so violently in their own newspapers that Masson began to fear the worst. He learned that Ribbentrop's services were compiling dossiers on hostile German-speaking Swiss journalists. Messages had already been received from Berlin demanding that the editors of three most important papers of the Confederation should be removed, at the head of the Agence Telegraphique Suisse be severely reprimanded for the partiality of his radio communiques. When these suggestions were not taken up, the head of the press section in the Foreign Ministry in Berlin publicly threatened the journalists with exile or worse after the occupation of Switzerland. This tactic came to be known as the, and I can't pronounce that, that's just Blutschuldthesis, the thesis that if blood flowed in Switzerland, it would be completely the fault of the Swiss press. Brigadier Masson favored more subtle action. Through diplomatic channels, had tried in vain to soft pedal such overt hatred of the Germans. At last he burst out angrily. If they really want to let themselves go, why don't they come out in the and openly side with the Allies? Thus, with no desire to exacerbate an already explosive situation, Maussan arranged for his meeting with Schellenberg to take place in the great secrecy. At dawn on Friday, October 16th, Maussan's chauffeur picked up Schellenberg and Egan at the frontier, wearing civilian clothes, of course, without anyone suspecting their identity. At Wolfsburg, along with Maussan and Mayer, was Captain Paul Holzack. They welcomed the SS officers warmly. The Germans were to stay until Sunday evening, October 18th. Despite the warm and sunny autumn weather, they would not leave the house. No risk would be taken, no expense spared to make things as pleasant for the guests as possible. Maussan hoped for a great deal from this second meeting. During the long weekend that followed, Schellenberg surpassed himself. He was at his most calculating, charming, amusing his hosts with juggling, card tricks, and sleight of hand, regaling them with edited versions of his life story. Indeed, to hear Schellenberg talk, it seemed that the only thing that was really mattering to him was Irene, his second wife since 1940, who was of Polish descent, and her five children from the first marriage. Overwhelmed with work as he was, Schellenberg counted it as a great pleasure to be able to escape for a few days to come to Switzerland among friends. He insisted that he would never forget that weekend, for he needed rest. In Berlin, in the Führer's entourage, he was known as the March Violet, a term used to denote those who had rallied to Nazism after the party came to power in 1933. And many were jealous and made things difficult for him. It was an exhausting business being continually on the defensive. The envious could soon be turned into enemies. Nothing was impossible in that slightly mad, plot-infested Reich of theirs. Quote, "So my office has to be a fortress," unquote, he continued. "It is a large room with a thick carpet. In it there is a very beautiful old cupboard. I called it my poison cupboard, in which I keep my personal files, a habit I picked up from Heydrich. It was he who gave me the most confidential file of all, establishing that Adolf Hitler is of Jewish descent, incredibly as that may sound. Poor Heydrich. He was obsessed by it. He tried to find Jewish ancestors for everyone around him. Quote, I had to set up a system of photoelectric cells that gave the alarm as soon as anyone approached the chest of my cupboard in my absence. When I'm there, two machine guns concealed in my desk are trained on whoever is talking to me. In an emergency, I simply press a button. Quote, when I go abroad on a mission, I have an artificial tooth prepared, containing a lethal dose of poison to prevent my falling into Allied hands," unquote. To prove his point, Schellenberg opened his mouth and showed Maussan the tooth. Then, with a slight smile, he removed the large blue stone from the ring he was wearing. Its bezel held a small transparent capsule containing cyanide. Had Schellenberg came to Switzerland simply to talk about himself, for the rest, he had not mentioned his previous meeting with Maussan, yet he had kept his word. The international press agentur had suddenly stopped the flood into Switzerland of its inflammatory publications, and Morgelli had been freed. A plane had taken him from Stuttgart to the military airfield at Dubendorf near Zurich, where his fiancée awaited him. Maussan and Schellenberg spoke of the war and of the miseries it entailed. Schellenberg indulged in one of his favorite sins, attributing to the aims of others, in this case those of Admiral Canaris and his group, to himself. He implied that he was concerned about the way the war was going, that he would be willing to serve in an intermediary between Germany and the Western Allies with a view to negotiating a compromise peace. He also hinted at the possibility of forming a united front after such a peace against Bolshevism in the East. Britain was still too weak to open a second front and was awaiting the arrival of strategic materials from America, materials that were slow in coming. When the United States threw in their full support, the balance would be destroyed, he admitted, to the detriment of Germany. Schellenberg told Maussan that he had discussed this problem with Himmler 2 months earlier in August 42 at Zittmeyer on the Russian front. He had even suggested to Himmler that the construction of the new Europe that could be created should be based on that of Switzerland, which was a perfect model. Himmler had agreed that he should try to make approaches to the West, and he undertook himself to convince Hitler before Christmas 42 and at the same time to eliminate Ribbentrop, who was implacably opposed to any kind of idea of separate peace. Schellenberg ridiculed Ribbentrop, a lamentably poor figure as a foreign minister. He had hoped to get some reaction to his expansiveness out of Masson, but Masson remained noncommittal and far more difficult to manipulate than Schellenberg had thought at first. On his part, Masson was interested but also infuriated by his small talk, for Schellenberg had said nothing about the real problem, nor thrown any light on why he had come to Switzerland. When the night of October 18th arrived and Schellenberg still had not revealed his intentions, Masson realized he must broach a subject that had long been bothering him. In the most casual manner possible, he mentioned the existence of a document that could be terribly compromising for Switzerland. It was the Gesson-Gamelin military convention, signed long before the outbreak of the war, a document that could have severe consequences on the future of the entire Confederation, for it could partly justify the accusation leveled repeatedly against Switzerland by Germany, that it could no longer be regarded as a neutral country. It was an explosive document that should never have fallen into Germans' hands. However, as Masson had known for some time, it was in their possession. Proof of this had appeared shortly before Masson's first meeting with Schellenberg at Walschut, and in a very curious way. The Gamelin affair had begun in 1940. After the appointment of General Maxime Weygand as chief of the French army, General Maurice Gamelin, fearing the war was lost, abandoned a train carrying the archives of the general headquarters at Charette-sous-Loire on June 19th. German troops discovered the train and alerted Major General Ulrich Liss, head of the 3rd Section of the GIC, one of the secret services of the Wehrmacht. Liss had the convoy thoroughly searched. The booty was of astonishing proportion, whole cases filled with confidential documents. The text of an agreement of cooperation between the French and the Belgian armies, dated November 9, 1939, the plan of action and the identities of the French special agents in Romania, whose mission was the destruction of the petroleum plants supplying the Reich, the codes used by the Allies, and a top-secret note concerning the conduct of the war, and in particular, the attitude of observing towards neutrality aiding Germany, meaning at that stage, Sweden. Major General Liss studied all the documents and found the information to be of little more than historical value, except, that is, for an interesting French military convention with Switzerland, and Liss underlined two passages in the treaty. Quote, on 14 April 1940, General George, commander of the Northern Front, asked General Gamelin to form a group of 9 divisions which would cooperate with Switzerland, unquote. Quote, on 20 May 1940, General Pretelot referred to the task force forming by the 13th and 27th Infantry Divisions and the 2nd Brigade of Safius of the 7th Corps of the 8th Army, ordered to make contact with the left flank of the Swiss Army near Basel in the Gempen Gap. If Hitler were to learn of these papers, he would certainly denounce Switzerland officially for violating its neutrality and immediately launch an invasion. He had invaded Holland for less. He had attacked Poland on slender pretext forged by his own secret service. Having had full knowledge of the Gamelin Treaty since 1940, Masson's worst fears concerning its whereabouts had only just been realized when he was told by a friend at the German embassy in Bern that the deeply incriminating document was indeed in the hands of the SD in Berlin and could be brandished at any time. The Confederation was obviously in grave danger. Masson had sought in vain for a means of disarming this mind that jeopardizes country's freedom. Now, with the enigmatic Schellenberg so mysteriously accommodating, Masson resolved to ask him what he planned to do with the military convention. Quote, you claim to be a friend of Switzerland, then show it. What do you hope to do with that old treaty now? Unquote. Schellenberg showed no trace of surprise. He knew all about this interesting military convention. It lay in his Switzerland file. He could well understand the Swiss general's uneasiness about it. So convinced Masson that he was indeed a friend of Switzerland, he would promise to destroy the papers on his return to Berlin. Bern would never hear of them again. And again he gave Masson no sign of what he wanted in exchange. As he took leave of his host, Schellenberg said simply, quote, "I am very concerned for the safety of the Führer," unquote. Only then did Masson realize that Schellenberg had repeated these few words several times during the weekend, words that were to haunt him later on. I want to close out here today because you'll never know how much intelligence, how important intelligence is, something that the right wing know nothing about, never practice it. Never developed agents and spies and so forth. Maybe once in a while, but nothing important. They've always been reactionary. And wars are not won by just reaction. I remember a book by a general, World War II, I read one time. I forget his name. Defense will not win a war. And it's very true. And the reason I dwell on Schellenberg in this book, Man Called Lucy, is so goddamn important. If you really want to understand and put to use ideas that come out of this intelligence work to use in the future. In fact, I was so impressed by Schellenberg that one of my agents, yeah, I do have them. I guess they're not agents. They're just lone wolves that happen to end up in certain places. And that his code name was Schellenberg. He's done a lot of good work for me. Supplied me with a lot of information. Now you don't get heavy duty intelligence operations and so forth in the right. You never will. And of course the racial struggle are so wrapped up in Hitler worship that so much of their stuff can't be trusted because they make too many allowances for Hitler and people like that. You got to look at the history in cold, hard reality and not be flip-flopping back and forth one way or the other. You got to take it the way it is. When the Russians did something right, the Russians were fine. If the Russians didn't, well, they weren't fine. You got to look at things practically, you know. So I've got this piece out of a book, and you can get this book. It's called Who's Who in Nazi Germany, by Robert Wistrick, which is a good book to go quickly to an outline of who people were. So I'm going to read you this page here about Schellenberg. Walter Schellenberg, he was born in 1910, died in 1952, supreme head of the espionage services of the Third Reich and Himmler's right-hand man towards the end of the World War II. Walter Schellenberg was born in Saarbrücken on the 16th October 1910, the seventh child of a piano manufacturer. After receiving his law degree at Bonn University, where he demonstrated a passionate interest in Renaissance history and in political implications, Schellenberg joined the NSDAP and the SS in May 1933, subsequently entering the Gestapo in the late summer of 1934. The career-minded young adventurer, who spoke English and French fluently, attracted the attention of Heydrich and Himmler, who made him his personal aide. He was entrusted with organizing the Eisengruppen for the Czech campaign in 1938. 4 years later, he negotiated on behalf of the Reich Main Security Office with the Wehrmacht over the zones of authority in which these same Eisengruppen were to enjoy full freedom in executing their plans as regards to the civil population, in effect to license to kill civilians, so, you know, just like Obama and Bush and all the rest of them do. Schellenberg had earlier been involved in the Venlo incident, November 1939, when he led a detachment of armed Germans across the Dutch border to kidnap two British military intelligence agents. Major Schellenberg, at the time already head of the Gestapo Counterintelligence Division, was decorated for his exploit and promoted at the age of only 30 to SS Major General. Boy, that's young. From 1939 to 42, Schellenberg was deputy chief of the AMTVI, or 5-1, of the RSHA, in charge of the Political Secret Service for foreign countries. In 1940, Schellenberg was charged with preparing the special search list, GB, of 2,700 prominent people of the United Kingdom to be arrested following the projected invasion of Britain. He also claimed to have written the highly secret handbook, Informationsschrift, intended to aid the Nazis in looting Britain and stomping out resistance. Another special mission, this time was in Lisbon, Portugal, to kidnap the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. Hitler intended to use them as instruments in his search for a peace agreement with Britain, ended in a complete fiasco. Nevertheless, it wasn't really a complete fiasco. There was just a timing problem. You know, these guys that write this stuff, you can tell when they're not being fair and balanced, as Fox News would say. There was just a mix-up in timing down there on that operation. Nevertheless, the same way with killing Castro. It was right up until his girlfriend was bringing the poison right into the lobbying, almost ready to go up to the bedroom, to have her get together with Castro and give him the poison when she backed out. It's just a timing problem. Nevertheless, as Himmler's protege, Schellenberg was promoted in 1942 to head the AMT-6, that's what it is, of the RSHA and chief of security in the occupied territories. In 1944, he was appointed head of the United SS and Wehrmacht Military Intelligence, standing second only to Himmler in the Gestapo hierarchy. He used his agents to enter into secret negotiations with the Allies and prodded Himmler to establish contact with the Swedish Red Cross officials. Count Folke Bernadotte about surrendering the German armies in the West. Schellenberg was eventually tried by the American Military Tribunal in Nuremberg and acquitted of genocide charges, claiming successfully that he had no direct involvement with the final solution. He was, however, found guilty of complicity in the murder of Russian prisoners of war and sentenced to 6 years imprisonment on 2 April 1949, released in December 1950. He died in Italy in the summer of 1952 at the age of only 42. So that's a little background on Schellenberg. Anyhow, that's the name of the game. And if you don't have a lot of spies and people in good jobs or supplying important information, you have nothing. If you have no intelligence division or intelligence people that are smart and know how to do it in any movement, you can't win. You can't win. And that's one of the reasons why the right wing can never win. I don't mean the big shots at the top of the right wing, you know, the big politicians and so forth. I'm talking about, you know, the so-called conservatives and the so-called patriotic ones that are worried about their guns being taken away and their babies being killed, all that kind of stuff, that never go anywhere because they're nothing but reactionaries. And I suppose this is some of the reasons why some of these university-educated right-wingers don't fancy Tom Metzger too much, because I never went to university, and I had quite a bit of military training, but it was mostly in technical fields and like that. But I learned how to study things objectively and use, discrimination in study and all that kind of stuff, and the art of contrary thinking, and it served me pretty well, and that's what I'll do to the end. 14-5, see you tomorrow. Tomorrow is Wednesday, yeah.
ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, proudly presents the Insurgent Radio Network.